Okay. As usual, we start on time. Warning, I mean, this is a tutorial, I mean, real tutorial. Which means everything I'm going to say is elementary. And the only excuse is it may be elementary for different people, and some things will be less elementary for other people. But if you feel that it's totally elementary for you, just feel free to leave, because it is elementary. This is stuff that I teach students, well, graduate students, okay? But I believe that it somehow would be helpful for if some pieces of it you're missing, just to see a bigger picture, because most of what we are going to talk this week is this quantum turbulence, well, at least theoretically and numerically, it's about this Gross-Pitayevsky equation or Minier-Schrödinger equation. And it's, well, problem I feel theory friends would disagree, but this is probably the most ubiquitous and universal model that one sees in physics. I think that if one does search, that more theoretical paper devoted to this equation in one, two, three, four other dimensions than to any other equations in physics. So that's why it may be worth having kind of a wide view on it, because you would not believe how many people working with the same equation that probably some of you are working with a completely different perspective. So, and I'll be mostly talking classically, because we'll have a lot of quantum stuff later today and tomorrow, but from time to time I will be telling, okay, this is also could have this quantum interpretation, and I'll be using psi. Okay, so psi always reaches quantum bells. For classical person, this equation appears in absolutely any situation in which you have almost monochromatic wave. So if you are interested in waves, you have amplitude which is depends on wave number and also some function of time, and you write the equation for this wave, and it's this equation and plus nonlinear term, which I specify in a moment. So you are saying, okay, now in my Fourier space, I am it's near some point which is k naught. So only wave numbers which are near to this wave number are excited, and so I may expand my omega, saying that it's omega at k naught plus d omega dk, k minus k naught plus, let me call q, k minus k naught. So what you would have here is qi, qj, and d2 omega dki, kj. And you usually stop at the second point of expansion, and then you plug it here, and then you get the equation for which is convenient to write, if you write ak of t as exponent minus I omega at point k naught t psi of k, you may say q of t, that's an envelope of this fast wave. We also put it k naught r plus. So you have a monochromatic wave, and you write equation for its envelope, assuming that this is a slowly changing function. So the main fast evolution is like this. And then let me write it with on one half and all that stuff. For psi, you get the equation, which is d dt plus eq d omega d dk plus minus q parallel to the k naught. So k naught is some vector, it gives you direction, and so you have q parallel squared times omega 2 prime over 2 and minus q perpendicular squared over 2k omega prime. Omega prime and d omega dk is the same. And this is the linear part of your equation. And now you must, because now you already eliminated fast evolution, you have only slow evolution because k is a little bit maybe not equal to k naught, then you need to account nonlinear terms. But now, if you want to account nonlinear terms, what could be here nonlinearity? Psi squared, psi cubed, etc. The point is that all psi squared nonlinearity, they come out of cubic Hamiltonian, they are all non-resonant. Namely, that if you have all waves having almost the same frequency, you cannot have three waves so that their sum of frequencies cancel. That means that quadratic nonlinearity is always non-resonant, and you can eliminate it by some canonical transformation. And as a result of it, the lowest nonlinearity that one needs to take into account is almost cubic nonlinearity, because it's the first resonant nonlinearity. You can find four waves always, which their four frequencies are almost the same and cancel to zero.
But that only works if you have no other externally broken symmetries.
Huh?
If I take this system and I break the symmetry and impose a wave number, for example, then you get quadratic terms.
No. If you have an envelope and all frequencies, it might be that this frequency is zero for some reason. Mm-hmm. But if this frequency is non-zero, then quadratic term is always non-resonant, no matter what is the symmetry.
For this frequency, unequal
to
zero.
If you have, sorry for theoretical, if you have any process in which you have omega into two omegas or two omegas into one omega, they all have frequency which are close, you cannot cancel them. But the moment that you allow for this, then you always have this a little bit higher than omega naught, this a little bit less, this is a little bit higher, this is a bit less, together they cancel out. So this is absolutely general statement, and that's why this equation...
As long as omega k0 is unequal to zero.
Yeah, as long as omega naught is non-zero.
Yeah, but
I think what Eberhard is asking is, like, if you have a mean flow, like in, say, Swiss-Wendler equation, then you can get the psi squared
that would be a situation in which omega naught is zero. So in a sense, the statement that quadratic nonlinearity is non-resonant is very general statement, just because you have a frequency and you expand around this frequency. So the first term here,
hexagons.
You're overeducated guys. So
did you go back? You changed it.
Huh?
You have Q is the transform.
Q is K minus K naught.
Right, then you have e to the minus I K omega of K naught plus, and I cannot read that.
What? It's A K naught R. It's a function. I already made it as a. Yeah, right. I don't need it. Does this. So it's all in Fourier space, no R space yet. So what I would have here, I would have some coefficient which I describe interaction between this Q and Q1, Q2, Q3, and it would have A1, Psi1 complex conjugated, Psi2 plus Psi3, and delta function of Q plus Q1 plus minus K2 minus K3. What is written here is just a special resonance, or if you wish, translational invariance of the media, and I integrate over dq1, dq2, dq3. Now, because my q's are so close to each other, then again, in this approximation, because I'm taking into account this weak nonlinearity, I may consider this dependence unimportant and replace this as a constant. This is some function, different for different media, but because these q's are in a very small vicinity of k0, I can replace it by a constant, and that's what makes it so universal, that now, no matter what is the medium, different media have different dependence, but it's all gone in this limit of envelope and of considering. So this is the equation which describe almost monochromatic wave in a nonlinear medium. Okay? Now, of course, what you do after all this manipulation, you Fourier transform it back. And then in R space, you will get the equation, which you would all recognize now. That would be, let me use omega prime, d psi dz, and z is a direction along k naught, my initial wave vector. And this is d2 psi dz squared, and this is minus omega prime over 2k. Let me write it, Laplacian transversal psi, and it's equal to t plus I t psi squared psi equal to zero. That's a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So this is 5 minute derivation of this equation, and I saved you everything. I mean, nothing important is here, and it's that simple. It's possible, and it shows why it's so universal. Now, you see how general it is. So basically, you can even consider optics where omega 2 prime, or acoustics where omega 2 prime is 0, it's okay. So this term would be absent, but this term would be present. So diffraction always present, and second derivative is always present, even for optics. For waves on the water, you will have, of course, this term, etc. Now, usually, we pass to the reference frame, which moves with the group velocity. This is the group velocity of my packet. And then, in this reference frame, I have this equation, which is written like this, d psi dt. And then I may stretch and compress this as long as they have the same size. This is always positive, but this could be positive or it could be negative, depending on the dispersion. If they all both have the same sign, it's convenient to stretch and compress it and have this something. Let me write it with 1/2 plus t psi squared psi. And this is the most general form of this equation. But then again, one must remember that in this Laplacian, I can combine transversal part and longitudinal only when they have the same coefficient and it's really an elliptic equation, not hyperbolic. And of course, it's a Hamiltonian equation, which means that E d psi over dt is a variation of Hamiltonian with respect to psi complex conjugated. And the Hamiltonian is an integral 1/2 grad psi squared omega 2 prime plus t psi to the 4. The integral over dr. And when you look at here, then again, it's clear why it's so universal. If you would do quantum mechanics, that would be kinetic energy and the simplest interaction, namely scattering of particles on each other, having the coefficients of scattering amplitude independent of their momentum, which is again true as long as momenta are not very much different. Okay? Now,
Your top line there, omega prime is partial omega partial k.
Where this top line?
Yes.
This is omega prime is d omega dk.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and in principle, it's a vector, but here, what stays here is projection on the direction z, which is the direction of k naught.
Wait, have you got the physical space at this point?
This is Fourier space. Right. This is a Fourier transform into physical space. This is z.
A single mode.
This is z. This is
the linearization still about a single mode with the nonlinearity on the far right hand that was on the far
yes.
right hand side. That's what you've done. It's just the linearization of a single mode.
It's not a linearization. It's an expansion of wave near a given wave number. It's quasi-monochromatic wave.
Okay, so
it's an envelope approach.
It's an envelope approach to a quasi-monochromatic wave, which is why partial omega partial k makes sense, because you're only talking about something around a single wave. And you're saying that is, when you go to the equation below, this becomes just the translation or something, it gets absorbed someplace?
This term I can absorb by passing to x minus omega 2 prime z minus
so
omega 2 prime t, z r perpendicular.
Absorbed as the, you have a perpendicular Laplacian that's perpendicular to the wave number.
Sorry, well, okay, I did it too fast. Okay, so.
Isn't that the rotating frame that you are in there?
What I said is that if I pass to this reference frame, then I would get, sorry, okay, that was too fast. Then I would get this equation, I omega 2 prime over 2 d2 psi over dz squared minus omega prime over 2k Laplace perpendicular psi plus t psi squared psi equal to 0. Now I may contract.
That's the Laplacian perpendicular to the wave number of your monochromatic wave. You're talking about perpendicular Laplacian.
That's Laplacian, which means the Laplacian in the direction perpendicular. This is all in space now.
Yes, right.
And this is r perpendicular to the direction z, and z is the direction of the wave.
Yeah.
Now, when it's like this, I can stretch this by a factor omega 2 prime divided by omega prime k, And if I stretch these coordinates by this factor, they would have the same factor omega 2 prime over 2. And I would call this d2 dz squared plus Laplace perpendicular, I would call it total Laplace.
Right.
And this I would now write as a nonlinear Schrodinger equation or Gross-Pitayevsky equation that you all have seen and know. Now, this could be one-dimensional, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, but then again, when they have different signs, and this is always positive, and this could be negative, then you need to treat them separately. If I am too fast, then you slow me down. Yes, Jim?
What's the physics? There's no master.
Huh?
There's no master. That must be missing because of, we have certain symmetry. Let's go back to the symmetry. There's no psi squared term.
No, of course there is a mass term. It is just absorbed. I have this frequency.
Right.
Over here, it is just absorbed.
We could put it back.
I could put it back if you wish. I just don't want. But at the end, when I solve all this, I need to step back and recall that actually I am talking about envelope in space and in time.
That I understand, but when you put a mass term.
But mass term, in my terms, is a frequency at 0k. Non-zero frequency at 0k. That's what mass for me. Sorry, I'm a classical person.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But
so at 0q, I have a non-zero frequency, which is this. This is my mass term. I just eliminated it by passing to the envelope of this high-frequency motion. After I do all my calculation about envelopes, my real physical field would contain this frequency at 0q, which is mass term in you. Okay? So that's why this Hamiltonian is completely universal. This could be zero, then some symmetry could make it zero. Then, again, some derivations that I do need to be resolved, because I assume that this frequency is large and everything else is small with respect to this frequency.
Okay, I was just sort of thinking that the real deep physical difference in field theories with masses and massless field theories. I was just wondering what the philosophy was.
A deep physical difference.
You have finite ranges of interactions and things like that.
I don't know. Actually, this omega disappears. No.
Are you sure your answer is answering Jim's question? Jim's asking why there isn't a psi, a linear term in psi in the equation, which would come from a psi squared term.
But psi squared,
can you just explain more slowly where you absorbed.
Okay, if I would have this term here in the equation, this term would give me m psi.
Yes.
Okay, and that would, when I would solve this equation, just forgetting anything else, it would give me psi proportional to exponent minus I m t.
That's right.
Which means frequency at a zero wave number. But I already have it. At 0q, which is k minus k naught, I have a frequency. I absorb it into my definition. Okay, so I can put it back, but that's, I don't need it because this is something which is a very fast evolution and trivial, and I can always restore it to the answer. What I'm now be talking about is a slow evolution, very non-trivial, space dependent, and all this. Okay. But then again, when you try to quantize this equation, that's probably something that you would be that would probably play a role. Okay.
The only nice thing about retaining that linear term, from my point of view, is then the trivial solution is a flat field, not at zero, relative to the way you've expressed it, where the trivial solution is a flat field at zero, which makes it appear there's nothing going on, even though there is.
Right, but
in a moment,
we'll have a frequency without all this, even in terms of psi. So, what is the simplest solution of this equation? It's a constant. is non-zero frequency, of course. So if I take psi, which is a constant independent on coordinate, it still must have a frequency because of this term, and it would have a frequency. And this solution, with all due respect to our quantum friends, we call condensate. Because it's a monochromatic, nonlinear wave, it has a frequency shift because of its amplitude. So it is this linear frequency shifted by this, and it's space independent. That's what we call condensate, and of course this is a direct analog to a condensate. It is in any dimension. And now the question is whether this solution is stable. Okay? So you take this solution and you write delta psi, and you linearize it, and you get spectrum of perturbation. Namely, that you say that delta psi is proportional to exponent I omega k. I again call it k, so we forget about this k. Nothing happened like this. We now have everything else completely in terms of this nonlinear Schrodinger equation or Gross-Pitayevsky equation. And omega k t plus I k r. And then we get omega as a function of k is a Bogoliubov formula for the spectrum, which is t omega 2 prime a squared k squared plus omega 2 prime k to the 4 over 4. Okay? So this is a Bogoliubov formula derived 50 years ago. And in the Gross-Pitayevsky case, Gross-Pitayevsky is usually when you have T positive, this is called Gross-Pitayevsky. When you have any T, it's called nonlinear Schrodinger. So when T is positive, it's two positive terms. When T omega 2 prime positive, let's put it distinctly. And this is just a spectrum of perturbation of the condensate. Now when T omega prime is negative, then omega at low K, omega squared is negative, and we have an instability. T omega 2 prime less than 0 is a criterion of instability, which is called Light-Hill criterion, because fluid dynamical people actually discovered it before. But the instability itself is called Benjamin Fair, because it was first discovered in the simplest case. I did not say which direction K looks. And now, if we go look back at our equation, then depending on which direction it looks, I either exploit this term or I exploit this term. So the simplest case is when k is parallel to z, which is actually k naught. Namely, I have a wave, my initial wave, and I impose modulation on it in the same direction in which its wave number. So I impose longitudinal modulation. And then this is a criterion. Because what determines my longitudinal dispersion is omega 2 prime, right? And it's a simple criterion. It's absolutely trivial for quantum people because it tells them that in your Hamiltonian, two terms must be of different sign so that system is unstable. If they are of the same sign, the sign of Hamiltonian is unimportant. You can, it's Hamiltonian system, t to minus t, you can always change. But if you have different signs, then, for example, consider this positive. This is like kinetic energy. If this is negative, this is an attraction. And it's clear that if you have this condensate, which is a constant probability to find particles everywhere, at some point you make psi larger, and this point, this term, would be stronger than this. On a stationary solution, they are balanced. Now, if at some region you would create a bump in psi, it would be attraction that would bring it further and make an instability. For classical people, of course, it's all about dependence on the velocity and frequency on the amplitude. So all this could be re-explained in terms of omega 2 prime, which is a dispersion. And what is this is the second derivative of frequency with respect to wave number. And this is the second derivative of frequency with respect to the amplitude. I just want you to see simple geometry of it. I have a frequency which depends on wave number and amplitude. And I want the surface of this frequency to be concave. The moment it has a saddle, it is unstable. T is derivative of frequency with respect to a squared. as already clear from here. It's in addition to frequency, which is TA squared, if I differentiate frequency. Okay, so for classical people, this Lighthill criterion is just a statement that my velocity must be convex or concave, but should not be a saddle as a function of wave number and amplitude.
Should not be a what?
A saddle, which means that it should not be positive curvature in one direction and negative curvature in another direction.
Should not be a saddle.
A saddle, yeah, sorry, I mean, my Siberian accent is always making difficult some terminology. Now, an interesting point here is, for example, if you go to the beach, then you see when the front is very far, it generates almost periodic wave. You know, the dispersive wave, what we see, we always see periodic because different frequencies propagate with different velocity. Somewhere we look, we see only one frequency. But it's not exactly periodic, it has this modulation. In particularly, Russian sailors have this mysticism about ninth wave to be a killer, etc. Actually, if you look here, you'll see that the most unstable wave number depends on amplitude, so it's all just folklore and completely wrong. But you may ask why the waves on the water have this criterion satisfied. Because omega for gravity waves is gk. So omega is the square root of k, and its second derivative is negative. So why it's still positive? That's something pretty non-trivial. Well, gravity wave on the water is like pendulum made of water. But if you look at a pendulum, its period increases with increasing of amplitude and eventually turns into infinity. So the frequency must decrease with the amplitude. But for water wave, frequency actually increases with the amplitude. And this is because the wave changes its form. It eventually gets into the cusp. And its frequency, it's not like a pendulum, it really increases. So T is positive, omega 2 prime is negative, and that's why we have this ninth wave as a result of modulational instability. Now, if you look perpendicularly, namely, you can see the perpendicular perturbation, this one, okay? Then this is always positive, and then the criterion for K perpendicular to K naught, the criterion of instability is T less than zero, which tells you that the amplitude must decrease the frequency. Again, it's very clear to visualize if you have some wave propagating, I just took kind of one maximum, and you make this higher over here, okay, then you want it to propagate slower, then after a while it would be like this, and focusing would increase its instability. Okay?
What does the curvature mean?
Curvature means that if you make this amplitude not uniform along the this constant phase, then this part would propagate slower if T is negative. And if this part would propagate slower, it would bend the front, and further focusing would increase this bump even higher. That's a mechanism.
That's what focusing means.
That's what focusing means.
So
that's how optics blows nonlinear crystals by this mechanism.
Really common in optics for that to happen. It's very common in optics. Absolutely. Even air, I think, actually, if you get the intensity high enough, does that.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, in optics, you can have different signs of T. Okay. So now, as we know,
your argument. The Lighthill Benjamin Bear argument only had to do with longitudinal waves, that is, perturbations in the direction of
What it tells you, it does not know about longitudinal transformation. Take this equation, okay? Now, in this equation, instability means product of this times this must be negative. Now, if this would happen to be perpendicular, then what stands here is actually this factor, okay? So you use this criterion for longitudinal, for transversal, does not matter. In formal ways, it is just what stands as here, or what is here and here. I mean, that's even easier to look at the Hamiltonian. If you consider transversal perturbation, what stands here is omega prime divided by k. Okay, now how to guess what happens as a result of this instability?
I was distracted. So what do you call this criterion? Lighthill something?
Lighthill criterion.
Lighthill. So this is the Benjamin Fair criterion in complex inscriptive lambda. Exactly the same one.
Yes, but it was invented by Lighthill.
A few years earlier.
And Yes. And because Lighthill is already deceased, I really want, you know, to call it by its proper name. It's Lighthill.
Well, but in the fluid dynamics community, in the complex insulata community, it's called the Benjamin Clare criterion. So you're rewriting history, so we should know. So this was done when, in the 60s or in the 50s?
It actually was done before Benjamin Fair, which is 1967,
yes,
right. Work. But then again, I am, you know, the last.
No, but that's fine. I just want to know.
To now do historical.
So the next time I call it the Lighthill criterion.
So when the instability, instability is called Benjamin Fair instability. That's for sure. Criterion is called Lighthill criterion.
When did the optics people? When did the optics people?
Askaryan is 1964. It took a couple of years, then Zakharov, Lebesgue collapse and all this stuff is 1967-68. Benjamin Fair 1967. But, you know, I can give you a separate historical lecture, why people discover it separately and why it was so important for completely different reasons. For Benjamin and Fair, the main interest was that there are no stationary wave of finite amplitude for water. It just revolutionized our thinking about water waves completely. They could not care less about quantum condensate optics or whatever you call it. But when at 70s I came, you know, to the Zakharov school, we were all taught all this together because it was considered to be absolutely universal, etc. But it was just few years that people started to look about it universally, which was early 70s. At 60s they were still doing it separately.
Yeah. I understand where the focusing instability coming from.
Yes.
But I don't see that it's Lighthill and Fair just another version of that.
Yes, this is just different version of the same thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Just to the same. Okay. Now what comes out of this instability? Let's talk a little bit about unstable case. So how one can guess what happens out of it? It's a complicated system. As it's unstable, we expect it to go into either some mode, which appears and stabilizes instability, or full way into turbulence. So how one can guess what's actually happened? And the one reason to do it is to use a way of thinking which is a very non-rigorous, but still very powerful, and I use it all the time, so I'll try to convey it. So, for example, let me consider that what happens to the psi, let's say, having the form of some packet, okay? And it has a size L, and it has some amplitude. Now, what is important about this equation, and is always when you try to guess the destiny of some complicated process, it's good to know integrals of motion, because integrals of motion, it's really something which tells you some general outcome, but I need to use it creatively, and I'll show you creative use of integral of motion. So what are the integrals of creative means that you conserve what you like and you don't conserve what you don't like. That means creative. Okay. So how to do it?
Now. Secondary criterion.
Yeah. So it's like financial mathematics. So what are the integrals of motion? Of course, Hamiltonian is an integral of motion. And of course, the number of waves. You remember, these are scattering. I freely switch from quantum language to, so these are scattering. So in a quantum language, it's trivial that n, which is an integral of psi squared over space, must be conserved. Okay? And of course, sometimes it is useful to think about it classically, because classically, it is an adiabatic invariant. Okay? And we'll return to it. And of course, the momentum is conserved. And you know, if I take psi grad psi complex conjugated minus psi complex conjugated grad psi, that's a current, and it is a momentum. So if I integrate over r, it's also an integral of motion. Okay? So those are three integrals of motion in this equation in any dimension.
And that's only true for quantum mechanics. Right.
I mean, no. Those are integrals of motion of this equation.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that.
Statement of applied math.
Of course, it's just applied math. Right.
No, this is applied math. This is if I consider wave, this is the momentum of the wave.
Yes, I understand that.
Absolutely classical object.
No, I understand that. I understand that.
Okay.
And N must not.
It's just the definition of N and N.
N must not necessarily be integral. Classical.
Of course not. This is just power. This is just, you know, if you say to laser people, this is a power that you put into laser.
What I was asking is, in a classical system, N is conserved?
Yes.
So it's a conserved.
All these three integrals of motion are conserved by this equation.
This equation, okay.
Yeah. This is energy. This is adiabatic invariant, because which is called action.
Yeah, okay.
If you divide it by Planck constant, that would be number of quanta, which must be discrete. So this is action, energy, and momentum.
This all comes from the Hamiltonian. If you don't have the Hamiltonian, then you're...
No. But this is a Hamiltonian equation.
I know, I understand.
Okay, good. Now, how I would guess the destiny of any process, I would say, okay, in these terms, first of all, n would be what? It would be psi squared times L in the power d, where d is space dimensionality. So let me express psi as n over L to the power d over 2, n 1/2. Okay? Now let me write Hamiltonian now in terms of this integral of n. What is Hamiltonian? Hamiltonian is psi squared divided by L squared plus, this is omega 2 prime, t psi to the 4, and all this is L to the power d. Okay? Now if I plug psi squared as n divided by d, and here I plug psi squared as n squared. Yeah, I'll be...
Erase your algebra. No fair.
Guys, everything exists online. I mean, this is a part of my book. I mean, you can download it. I mean, don't bother copying formulas. They all are online, and I also make a link over there. I want you to understand not to copy formulas. Okay? So it's L to the d, right? That's... or 2D, psi to the 4 would be 2D here, right? Okay, that's my Hamiltonian. And now, a trick. Now, that's a creative use of integrals of motion. So what I'm saying, I expect this packet to evolve. Well, it's kind of a large packet, and that instability, something happened to it. And so I'm asking how it evolves, what it conserves under this evolution. And I say, I want it to evolve slowly. It develops some kind of instability. Under this slow evolution, I expect it to preserve the adiabatic invariant, n. And I don't expect it to preserve energy. Energy will be radiated out of this pocket by some small waves which would escape it. And it would go to the minimum of energy compatible with this action. It's a very simple statement, and it's a very subtle thinking which goes beyond it.
Why isn't n radiated just the way the energy is?
Usually, I mean, first of all, it's just a plausible argument. It's not a proof. And we'll prove some of consequences obtained from here rigorously. On the other hand, it's plausible, because it's really that what happens to this packet is a slow process, and you expect adiabatic invariant to be conserved with exponential accuracy during a slow process. Okay? But energy does not need to be conserved in this region of space. We just run everywhere. And so I would expect that something, some kind of radiation would go out. This is nothing at this point but a plausible physical hypothesis. Okay?
There's no antiparticles here. I think that might be...
No. It just doesn't seem as obvious to me as it's...
No, it's not obvious. No. Ajib, you're absolutely right. It's not obvious. It's really something which is a non-trivial way of thinking, and as any non-trivial way of thinking, it could be wrong. So it would be nice to have some derivation, and I'll show you after it, at least in some case, a particular derivation. Yeah.
Well,
yes?
What is the small parameter? You probably said it, but I didn't catch it.
No small parameter here.
There's no small
just invariant.
But you have an adiabatic invariant, so you're looking for a separation of time scales
it's probably could be done. It's probably could be done considering some. I mean, really, if you want a small parameter, you need to take this packet very, very large and make some kind of a quasi-classics, which means that it's almost flat over here because that would be a stationary solution. It's a condensate. Okay, now slowly destroyed by instability, which you assume to be very slow, and that. But And some mathematicians try to do it, and I'm not interested in it because for me it's a qualitative thinking. So I don't want it to be quantitative way of calculation. I want it to be qualitative way of guessing the answer.
Is what you say is that maybe this isn't true? The nonlinearity is very strong, so it's very focused and it couples weakly to the waves. Is it what you say?
You want more from me that I can give you. This is not a perturbation theory with a good parameter. It's a qualitative way of thinking which allows you to guess. In a moment, we'll do exact calculation, which is called Talanov's theorem, and then you'll see what is what. Okay.
So it's Jim's question that. Your point is that the energy, the Hamiltonian, can radiate out from this wave packet, but I would view that as plausible because there's phase velocities and wave velocities of various sorts. So if you have any waves, there's a mechanism to get them out. But when you think about n, and I think about it as a mass instead of the condensate number, there really isn't any well-defined velocity associated with that, unless you have some entity that's propagating on its own, some solid in the flow that's propagating. So it has a much harder time escaping from a wave packet.
Yeah, I mean, that's, okay, so one can use different intuition for. Well, anyway, let's assume that this wild guess is meaningful, and let's see what it gives. So I plot Hamiltonian as a function of the size of the packet. I want to know whether it goes to collapse or to spread. That's my main question, that one I want to guess. So I have a packet. Somehow T, let me remind you that I'm working with T negative and omega 2 prime positive, just for simplicity, but I want to consider unstable case, and I want to know what happens as a result of this instability, whether it will collapse or go away. Okay? And I assume that this process, at least initially, is slow. Yes,
I still don't understand why we have to resort to guesswork, at least initially. If I wrote down an equation of motion for n, so I wrote down the equation dn by dt equals, and then worked it out using the equation of motion.
Dn over dt is equal to 0. Yeah. You'll see in a moment how one does derivation, and this is another non-trivial piece. But just before doing, look, this is a tutorial, so I'm here not to prove something. I'm here to teach you what I was taught how to think about this type of system. And I believe that this way of thinking is useful. It's not a way of calculating things. It's a way of just looking and guessing the answer. So I plot Hamiltonian as a function of L. And we start from d equal to 1. It's a different dimensionality. Now, this term is negative, okay? And this term is positive, right? So when d is equal to 1, this is 2 and this is 3. So at small l, this is important, and it goes to infinity like this. When l goes to infinity, this is 3, this is unimportant, and this is important, this is 2. I mean, this is common to them. And this goes to 0, well, l goes to infinity, but from the negative side. So it's like this. So it's clear that the form is like that. And then it has a minimum, which you would guess would be a size of a soliton, right? So my guess would be that this breakdown of condensate in 1D would stop at this scale, which is, of course, is determined by T over N, because it's a minimum of energy. It would radiate away anything else and just, you know, stop at this, which would be a local minimum of energy. And there are very beautiful mathematics which tries to make it a qualitative statement about geometry, which does not care about what is small, what is large. It's a qualitative statement. And I'm not going to go there, okay? Because I'm just not qualified. I mean, this is same. I mean, real geometry in functional spaces. Now, in 2D, when I look here, these terms have the same scaling, okay? Which tells me that depending on what my initial condition in my packet, if my Hamiltonian was initially, this is 2D, was initially negative, namely this term was larger, okay? So then it would be what? It would be like this. But if my Hamiltonian was initially positive, that would be like that, okay? Because we believe for some unknown mystical reason, the system goes to the minimum of its energy, then in this case it would go this way, and in that case it would go this way. Namely, if I start from a positive Hamiltonian, my packet would spread. If I start from negative Hamiltonian, my packet would collapse. It's all determined by initial condition in this case. Okay? And then if I consider it in 3D, that's what I have. This would be 6, which means that at small, this would be 5, and this would be 6, which means that it would go like this. And when it goes to it's like this, because this term is the main one. At small l, it's 6, which matters, and at large, it's this. So it's, then again, it tells me, it suggests me that if I really take my initial nonlinearity sufficiently large, that would mean that my Hamiltonian is not very high. It's over here, and also I need to put an initial packet on the right side of the game. Then I would go here. If I start here, I would go here. That's a suggestive thing. And now the derivation, which shows you that it's not that meaningless, it actually makes sense. And this derivation is called Talanov theorem, and it's a beautiful piece of mathematics, not very widely known, but it also has some beautiful mathematics behind it, which I believe is underexploited and may give a lot of many different things. So what Talanov suggested, he said, okay, now let's try to make it rigorous, namely, not calculate the derivative of integral, they conserve, but introduce the size L squared, which we defined as an integral of psi squared over multiplied by r squared with arbitrary initial position and integrate over dr. Now, if you calculate d over dt of L squared, it's a straightforward derivation. Students do it as a home exercise in my course. I mean, you, of course, you differentiate only psi. D psi squared over dt by continuity equation is the divergence of current, of moments, of momentum that we hold. Then one can prove the following beautiful statement, that it's 2 omega 2 prime integral grad psi squared dr plus d omega 2 prime t integral psi to the 4 dr. I mean, it's really kind of, one needs to do derivation. This is one of the little miracles that happen, and you can actually write it as 4 times Hamiltonian, this Hamiltonian, and plus 2 d minus 2 integral psi over 4 dr. Okay? T. I need, of course, t, because everything depends on the sign of t. Now it tells you that 2D is really special, because in 2D it is completely given. It's a Hamiltonian, it's a constant. And it tells you that indeed the sign of this constant determines the evolution. If this constant is negative, no matter what are your initial condition, this derivative is negative and the second derivative is negative and your L squared turns into zero, which means collapse. On the other hand, it also tells you that for dimensionality different from 2, you'll have something which is not an integral of motion, but something which enters into your initial condition and tells you which way you go. Relatively known, but behind this is so-called Lenz transformation, which exists in this, and which I never seen anybody exploited to get an exact statement like worded entities about different statistical moments in equilibrium or in turbulence, etc. So there is a class of transformation of psi in 2D, which is a particular 2D, which I never see. I have, you know, in my mind, back in my mind, some day I need to sit and write this word identities, which would be non-trivial calculation, which nobody exploited. Okay, so this equation is kind of peculiar thing.
Gregory, just a small note, in case it's useful for anybody, the D equal 1 case is also special.
That's what I'm going to tell.
Okay, go ahead.
Exactly right now. Okay, so now we see how different are different dimensionalities, and let's just spend some time just discussing different dimensionalities separately. So first of all, in 1D, we discover that there are not three integrals of motion, but infinity of integrals of motion. And then Zakharov, who this Shabbat, who invented this. So in one dimension, I mean, kind of unbelievably, one can write a system of linear equation that would look like this, and some two function, psi 1 and psi 2. And I want to write it just to show you how simple it is. After you discover it, psi 2. It's a spectral problem. Now, psi is a solution of nonlinear Schrodinger equation, namely that this is a function which depends on space and on time in 1D and evolves according to this equation. Now, this system of two linear equation has, of course, its solution depending on time, because psi depends on time. But energies do not depend on time. So all the spectrum of the system are infinite set of integrals of motion, okay?
This is
what is called Lux pair for one dimension Schrodinger. And it means that actually Schrodinger equation is a condition of compatibility of this system of equation. And because the system is linear, it means effective linearizability. And also this E, you can express this E in terms of psi. And they are integrals of motion. Yeah.
Same idea is also implicit in the inverse scattering thing, right?
This is an inverse scattering transform. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You do a scattering transform for this equation.
What is Z1, Psi1, and Psi2?
Psi1 and Psi2, some auxiliary fields for which I solve linear problems. Those are two linear equations. Okay?
Oh, so you've already solved for Psi.
No. Psi is a solution of nonlinear Schrodinger equation.
Right, so
psi 1 and psi 2, that's a solution of, this is a spectral problem on psi 1 and psi 2. Okay? Yeah. You can write it as an operator L acting on psi 1, psi 2 vector and giving E psi 1, psi 2.
Yeah.
Now, L operator is a function of psi, which is a solution of nonlinear Schrodinger equation, and non-stationary. But E's are integrals of motion. So now you would believe that at this point you completely end one dimension and nobody interested in one dimension. And you'd be completely wrong. Hundreds of papers are devoted still to one dimensional nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Of course, because of fiber optics. Okay? And for other reasons too. Now, what would people do if it's just all integrable? You just go and integrable means that you have psi as x0 and you can build psi of xt analytically. Okay? Now, the point is that people usually work with this or that discretization. And discretization always breaks integrability. In particular, if you go from this continuous model into a discrete model so that this term is replaced by the just finite difference like this, that immediately you would have something which is discrete in space. You have psi, this is I equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, and you have psi at every side. That's what people do with optical lattices, that's what people have in waveguides when they consider. Now, if you look at this Hamiltonian, and this is not an integrable anymore. Moreover, it has the solutions. For example, psi could be like this. Zero here, non-zero here, zero here, and zero everywhere. There are solutions also, I drew a few points like this. There are solutions just to show how it's non-trivial. Solution. This is an exact solution of this discrete system. And this solution lives on one side. on two sides, on one, two, three, four, five sides. Okay? Also, what people study in system like this is the superconductor isolated transition. Because as you change the ratio of these two parameters, when this omega 2 prime very, very small, it's limit which is opposite to continuum, is anti-continuum limit. It's a very, very discrete limit. And your psi function want to live on a side. As you increase it...
just to understand. When you mean solution of the discrete system, you mean that you're using the variational equation with time and taking the variation with respect?
It's exactly like your condensate was a solution before. Now you can have a solution which is on one side, on four, and those are pulses which people really observe. Now, as you change the ratio of these two parameters, you see that those pulses are stop existing and this all spread. This is isolator superconductor transition which people study, and of course not only in 1D, they study it in 2 and 3D.
These solutions, they must have exponential tails, don't they?
No, the exact solution. At a single point...
They are compactors, you mean?
Yeah, they're compact. Because it's a discrete system. In a continuous case, of course they don't exist. You cannot keep your psi to a single point.
Well, if you have these trees, they are coupled to their neighbors, so you have coupling to the neighboring sides. So necessarily they are influenced.
Yeah, but
in limit of very high coupling, this goes to one side.
Yeah, this is, those are pulses which are exact solutions, and you can have a family of them. I'm not sure they are...
It's kind of soliton then.
Yeah, it's kind of a discrete pulse.
It's caused the numerical a lot of problems.
Oh yeah, but they are observable. In particular, this could be, a waveguides. What people also work with waveguides. Now, I don't know.
You're talking about.
I was not good. So just wait. Bob. I don't know how much time because I was going to speak for about an hour, and I have something like 7-10 minutes to speak. We want to go beyond hour, or we want to finish within 1 hour.
Because that's very interesting.
Yeah, I can speak for 2 hours too. I mean, that's let's see.
6 hours.
we have your talk up.
You have found discrete solutions of psi one, psi two, the coupled psi one, psi two, with the background psi, which is also discrete. Psi has been found discretely.
A space is discrete, and in this discrete space, I have a Hamiltonian like this. Hamiltonian is the sum over I, psi I minus psi I plus 1 squared minus psi I to the 4 t epsilon. Okay? That's my Hamiltonian. Equations of motion are psi I dot I equal to the derivative of Hamiltonian with respect to psi I complex conjugated. End of story. This I Hamiltonian, those are equations. Okay? Now, these equations, of course, have these types of solutions. And I'm not going to talk more about
it. Not the psi 1, psi 2 couple.
No. Sorry, boy. Forget about it. I already...
that
was a mistake, though. never existed, They were just for over jealous people. I am back to nonlinear Schrödinger equation in a discrete version. Now, there is another way of discretization, which would be a spectral way of discretization. So we can write, of course, this equation in the Fourier representation, and we can write a Hamiltonian, which would be a sum over n squared omega 2 prime n squared psi n squared plus sum over n m, m I don't like, I, k, and that would be psi n psi I psi k psi l, and that will be delta function of n plus I minus k minus l. This is just a spectral representation. Now I can cut this spectral representation and consider only finite number of modes. Even in 1D, it also immediately breaks integrability. This is not an integrable system anymore. Dependent on the number of modes. And that, let me say a few words, because that could be important for numerical people, also is quite interesting. If I consider just three modes, psi naught, psi 1 and psi minus 1. So I have three modes, and this system has three integrals of motion. Of course, there's a six equation, those are complex. But for a Hamiltonian system, you don't need two n integrals of motion. You need only n integrals of motion by Liouville's theorem. So if I have six-dimensional, 3 degrees of freedom Hamiltonian system with three integrals of motion, Hamiltonian, n, and momentum, which I already erased, this is an integrable system. And in particular, one can draw a phase portrait of it, for example, in the variables which would be, let's say, psi 1 modulus squared here, and here would be the argument of psi 1 plus psi minus 1 minus 2 psi 1. So it's a phase shift of the side modes with respect to psi naught. And in this space, of course, because it's integrable, it's a simple tori that exists here, but here one can see the caricature of modulation instability. It has two fixed points. I mean, this is a condensate. Here, psi naught is non-zero, psi 1 and 0 on this line, okay? Now it has two fixed points. It goes like this. Of course, in the case when omega 2 prime t is less than 0, this is modulational instability in this three-mode system. If I start from a very small psi 1, this must go up, and this is modulational instability, right? And again, in the stable case, the phase portrait is like this. So if I start here, it just goes here, and everything is stable. Again, it's psi 1 squared, and here is this phase 5, okay? Now, it's clear that the moment that you do any perturbation to the system, what you have? We have a separatrix which goes from one fixed point to another. It's a heteroclinic trajectory. It connects two fixed points, okay? The moment that you introduce anything into the system, namely in fibers, you always have something which is kind of a small dissipation or whatever, then of course this manifold unstable which goes from here and a stable manifold which goes here is not the same manifold. You have a very complicated heteroclinic structure here and you have chaos. And this is indeed what people work with and observe and must struggle even in one-dimensional system as long as they change number of modes. Now, I want to call your attention to another interesting situation. When you have a case with a modulationally stable case, okay? So what you would expect, that if you have this mode condensate, which is psi naught, then it is a solution and it is stable. Now people can do really long lasers, like 200 kilometers long laser. And in this long laser, they would like to have this condensate, which for them simply means a very monochromatic wave. They want monochromatic waves. They don't want wide spectra to transport. Now, what they find out, that as they increase the amplitude of power that they transport, at some point, it breaks into many, many modes. And it's probably very much like turbulence in the pipe flow. So what we have here, we have a system which is linearly stable at any Reynolds number, if you wish. This condensate is an analog of laminar flow. Even though it is linearly stable, when its amplitude is sufficiently large, probably the domain, the attractor of its, let's consider it in the phase space, where I have, for example, psi naught amplitude in one direction, psi 1 in another direction, psi minus 1 in yet another direction, and it's multi-dimensional space, okay? And so I'm somewhere here, all this line full of fixed points, okay? As I move further and further, somehow the basin of attraction of this fixed point shrinks. And what I find myself, and that's what we see experimentally, and people also can observe numerically, the system actually goes far away from it. All the modes, many modes are getting excited. Again, it seems very much like turbulence in pipe flow. Namely, there are some transients. Why it's so difficult to study turbulence which in the case where there is no linear instability? When we have linear instability, we know where we go from laminar flow. First instability and second instability, we always know what modes appear out of it, and more or less we see the structure of the phase space. Now, if you have a your laminar flow is stable, but system still does not return to it. It somehow wanders somewhere in the phase space. You ask, what keeps it there? What are those objects which, I mean, those kind of in phase space? And that some special, what we now, because of Bjorn Hof, we now see this actually, and Bruno's work, that there are some kind of puffs which exist, and they're kind of a special, and they're transient. They aren't real solutions like solitons. See, something like this exists also in these long fibers, what keeps them from being stable. And that's what one of the very hot subjects now in studying this. Yes?
So I just want to explore that correspondence, because I'm very interested in the transient.
Yeah.
Just to turn on problem two. So do we see a super exponential lifetime of these?
Not yet. People are working on it. You know, in a sense, what Hof did was absolutely heroic. It was not only smart, it was just heroic. I mean, he had a million event statistics. And my fiber optic friends, I mean, they're working on it, but they also, you know.
But also, theoretically, so, for example, one thing that we saw is that this transition is in the universe and class direction. And you can work that out. This would be possible to do with this
equation
too, right? Has that been done?
No, it has not been done. Just a few months ago that I really, brought these people together, and you've seen some of them together in Eilat, they were started to talk to each other, and fiber people and pipe
so
people.
Even though
they're very similar, one has a long pipe and another has a long laser, it takes some time to realize that conceptually it's very similar. The real for conceptual similarity is the fact that you have turbulence in a system which is linearly stable. So laminar flow is linearly stable, still the system is turbulent, how the hell is getting turbulent? And I myself only recently started to understand that this is an interesting subject and important.
Do they see, as you increase the Reynolds number above about 25, you see puffs. Slugs actually start to spread when there's a characteristic velocity scales with the Reynolds number.
It's not that easy to look inside a 200 kilometers laser, trust me. But what we see a kind of a spreading of the packet and the widening of probability distribution. So it's really some strong fluctuation appears out of it. So you see, I mean, you switch your pumping, you see the condensate appears in stents, and then it kind of starts doing something like this. Just this is the power that your laser generates.
What do you mean by
condensate? Guys, I'm still in 1D. I don't even started to talk about 2D.
What is the condensate in the laser? I don't...
Just monochromatic wave. Condensate. A condensate, for classical people, is just a monochromatic wave of a given frequency. What they usually do, it's a non-trivial system. They have Raman pumping, etc. They have some maximum of pumping, so it excites some kind of a... Well, relatively narrow. So your gain is spectrally very narrow. At low amplitude, you have a very well defined, almost monochromatic wave that propagate. And you know, and there are different types of fiber, and you choose the fiber where omega 2 prime t is positive. And then you increase amplitude, and at some point you see this. You see that this is the amplitude of generated of this laser. It actually starts wildly fluctuating. Then you look inside, you see your packet very wide, and you see a chaos in this phase space of modes. In this phase space, you see trajectory going in wild, you know, kind of runs. Okay? Now, let's go to... I just wanted you to see the picture. I mean, we aren't going to... This is just how non-trivial and interesting is the life in even in 1D. Now, if we go to higher dimensions, then now we can really have something which is like turbulence. And I don't know to what extent big turbulence need or it all goes to your talk. So first of all, maybe before we start talking about turbulence, I want to say about equilibrium.
This is weak just, turbulence?
No. Equilibrium. Thermal equilibrium.
I'm going to be talking a little bit now, so.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll skip weak turbulence and refer it to my book, but at equilibrium, I want to say a few words. So in this equation, if I just... take the system and put it into contact with the thermostat at a finite temperature. Okay? Which means that I just put in the right-hand side. If you're a theoretician, then you put in the right-hand side something, you call it random noise. The amplitude of this random noise has a finite amplitude, you call it temperature. Okay? That's technically what you do. And then you ask what would be the statistics of this field psi. Okay? Or in other way, you can put initial random condition and ask how the system would evolve under the initial random condition. Well, in 1D, you know that initial random condition would never thermalize. The one-dimensional system is integrable, which means that there would be never equipartition between degrees of freedom. Okay? You can break the system into non-interacting set of oscillators. That's what integrability means. Now, in 2D, it's very interesting and non-trivial because we have a complex field with a short-range interaction, just a point interaction, which means that the moment that you allow for a stable condensate, you have vortices on this condensate, and these vortices can undergo this Berezinski-Kosterlitz-Tauliz phase transition, namely that you have vortex-anti-vortex pairs which are bound, or if you raise the temperature at some point, they start going away, and you have free charges, and you go from power law correlation to exponential correlation. This equation also contains all this as an equilibrium part of it. Okay? And now, about weak turbulence, I guess that I just might briefly say that if you really assume that this term is much larger than this term, namely that nonlinearity is very small, and now you do it only in two and three dimensions, for reasons that statistically you need some kind of region of integration. Okay, then one may really introduce a pair correlation function, which is a psi k squared. It's a simultaneous one, it's a function of time, and you call it nk. And for this, one can write a kinetic equation which has a form cubic in n. Okay? And this is called weak turbulence. And in this weak turbulence, you would expect that everything is known. I mean, we wrote a book with Zaharov about it some 20 years ago. Unfortunately, in this weak turbulence, this is a closed equation on the pair correlation function. One can write, because this equation is a conservation, it has this conservation law, then if you can write it in the form, first of all, this must have a form like this, because it conserves the total integral of n, then it must have a form of continuity equation in the phase space. This is a flux of action, but you can also write it as a for epsilon k, where epsilon k is omega k n k, and it would have a form of continuity equation for energy. Then you can find a solution which corresponds to the constant flux of energy, and it corresponds to the constant flux of action, because there are two integrals of motion. In the isotropic case, momentum third integral does not work, so you have two cascades. And if somebody needs a more detailed explanation, I can give it privately. I just don't want to bother you. The point is that if you look at it in different dimensionalities, then in three dimensions, the respective solutions are this p once, I'm writing nk, stationary solution is p one third k minus 3, and it's probably corrected by logarithm, even though this is not accurately derived, and this inverse cascade of wave action is minus 7 over 3. Now, what is interesting in 3D, that one can find a time-dependent solution of this equation, which has a self-similar form. N of kt could be found, which depends on time and on coordinate, and this is a self-similar propagation, namely n as a function of k. You start from something and you start propagating towards small k, establishing this spectrum, and this propagation is of explosive type. It has 7 over 2, if I'm not mistaken, and some function of k, t naught minus t, some power, which I don't remember. Now, what is interesting and important is that as you go towards small k, this term is getting less and less important because k is getting smaller and smaller, and eventually everything is getting nonlinear, and I guess Thomas would tell us what may happen over there. But the unsolved question is whether this explosive propagation start being unexplosive. Explosive means it reach, it creates condensate at k equal to zero in a finite time. Okay? Now, this is in a weak turbulence approximation. On the way towards small k, you leave the region of weak turbulence approximation and go into strong turbulence. Now, nobody knows whether in the strong turbulence case, this still be explosive just with a different speed of propagation. Even more, even less we know in 2D. This was 3D. And in 2D, it's even worse because what we know is this solution with a flux of energy, and it has a form k minus 2, and it now coincides with equilibrium, because I have an equilibrium distribution, Rayleigh jeans, which is a temperature, some constant plus another constant k squared. So 1 over k squared is an equilibrium. So it's probable, but equilibrium cannot transport flux. If you want to transport flux, you need to distort it. We believe that it's also distorted by some function, by some logarithmic function. Nobody actually derived this function. And then when we ask what would be the inverse cascade, a formal solution of this equation has a form k minus 4 over 3, which you write it in frequencies would be omega minus 2 over 3. But it behaves slower than 1 over omega. 1 over omega is, again, Rayleigh jeans distribution. Which means that it's carry a wrong sign of flux. If you want a flux going towards small k, then you want your solution to be like this, so that it goes from where you have more action to where it has less. So we don't know what actually carries action towards small k. Numerics, very old numerics and with very low resolution, suggest that the system hits itself, so it actually has this form of equilibrium is some function which is slow distortion of this equilibrium, and this would be different distortion at large k and at small k, and it would carry flux of energy this way and flux of action that way. Nobody was actually able to derive it, even in weak turbulence approximation. At that point, I stop. Everything beyond weak turbulence, you'll hear tomorrow and today. Okay, I apologize for taking more time.